This week on Pop of Culture, when your writing partner is your partner.
I often set up at the dining table, which is less than ideal for for our family, but
also a day in the life of a program director for a local arts institution. And we'll define some music genres.
This isn't techno, this is drum and bass, you primate.
Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Kara, guess what?
What?
This is our 40th episode.
Wow!
40th! How exciting is that? Congratulations to you, Kara.
And congratulations to you.
And congratulations to Jen Blackmer and to our producer, Luke Jones, and you, the listener, for listening to all of our episodes. We thank you for joining us on this Pop of Culture adventure. Lots more to come.
Stay with us as time flies.
That's right, when we're having so much fun. Coming up this hour, a conversation with two playwrights who started writing together and then fell in love.
Aww. To start today's show, we are speaking with Stephanie Michaels, the Director of Programming for the Cornerstone Center for the Arts. Welcome, Stephanie. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I know that you are fairly new to your position, so can you share with us how long you've been the director of programming for Cornerstone and kind of what you do day to day?
Yeah, so I've been at Cornerstone for 5 months now. I started June, so we may actually be at 6 months, but I am in charge of the programming. So that includes facility rentals, but also all of our educational programming and our outreach. I do have help with our rentals. We have a lovely, lovely coworker in Ashton who helps do all the rental stuff, and I help her when I can. So that's kind of my day to day, is just getting our classes scheduled is a feat of its own.
I was going to ask you a little bit about that. I know prior to your arrival in like fall of 23, there was a pause, and I know you're back now. And so is it a full force schedule? What does that look like?
I think it helps. We're slowly adding on classes, and it also helps me because I can slowly add on those days, right? Mm-hmm. The more days we add, the more classes. I think coming up in the winter, I think I counted we're at 50.
Great.
And it's a variety of classes. I have my little booklet with me. But we have everything from dance to visual arts. We just had a family come in who they all do kung fu. And so we're adding kung fu classes.
Nice.
Fun. We have a Magic the Gathering 101 class coming.
Oh.
It's for those interested. And we had some great partnerships in the community, and they have donated the starter packs for the students coming in for this class. So one other fun addition we have coming up is we are partnering with a local group called the Rogue Theater. And we're going to be introducing a movie every third Wednesday of the month in our auditorium, 18 and up, because some of these, you know, so we're balancing the kind of horror B film with some more not horror B film. You know, there's a way we could go with this, so we kind of mixed. So we're calling it Public Domain Theater, and we are going to start with a movie called Blackmail, and we're going to end with It's a Wonderful Life.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
I think one of the exciting things coming to Cornerstone is all the relationships I built prior. So I have a lot of relationships I've built over the past 10 years with artists, one of those being Ann Johnson. So I'm so excited to add Ann Johnson to our class listing. She's going to be teaching some figure drawing classes, some open studio classes, a painting class. So a lot of new fun things are coming.
Oh, yeah, that's super exciting. A lot of those things sound very interesting, and I'm sure they will appeal to a wide grouping of people. Can you talk a little bit about your the connections you've made? Like, are you a Munsonian originally?
So I am not. Okay. I am from Columbus, Indiana. Okay. And I came up here for Ball State, never left. I feel like that's a story we hear a lot. You just kind of come to Muncie and you kind of fall in love with Muncie in its own way.
We love that story.
And you just kind of stay. So I've lived here since at least 2005, but I've been working in Anderson for the past 10 years. So this is the first time from graduating to a job to actually living and working in the same place. It's taken, you know, a good 13, 14 years to live and work where I live.
Well, now we were talking about the courses building up and a lot of different artists and new disciplines coming in. So do you have any thoughts about what Cornerstone's vision is for the future? Will it look the same or?
So Cornerstone, I think, is in a moment of trying to figure out who we are and how we fit in this community, mm-hmm. and what the community wants from us, because we have an amazing arts community around here. We have, you know, the Civic is an amazing theater program. We have, you know, Harmony Dance Studio. They have fantastic dance studios. So how do we fit in with all of those, and what can we provide? So I kind of see us as a beginning first step. So maybe you're 60 years old and you want to try tap out for the first time. We're not competitive. It's just a introductory place to kind of learn and build on all these things. We also try to do our best to provide scholarships. So we always have scholarships available for anyone that needs it so that we can make classes affordable. So those are kind of our goals, is to have affordable classes that's welcoming and opening to kind of beginner levels. Dreams would be that we have a dance studio that, you know, they can go compete, you know, or it builds and we have more advanced courses. But at the moment, right now, we're kind of a beginner, exploratory, friendly place.
Oh, that's amazing. And I was unaware of the scholarships that you offer. So anybody can apply for the scholarships, or how does that work?
So at the moment, our grants are coming from the Indiana Arts Commission. Mm-hmm. They help provide us with our scholarships, and they're available to anyone that has a financial need.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm curious to know. So Cornerstone, for those people who know, is a really, really big space. It's a beautiful, it was formerly Masonic Temple?
Correct.
And so do you activate all of the spaces? I'm curious.
So good question. That is a question we are pondering right now, is how can we best use, because technically we have 6 floors, and how can we best use all those spaces? I know for a while on 3M, we had the Son of Scarvania. So we had a haunted house for a few years. They are no longer there. So that space is empty. And we're looking at what can we use that space for? How can we use it? What does the community, need that space? Can we give it to them? So at the moment, we're doing our best to figure out how we can best use all of these spaces. And we do also have renters in the building. We host Masterworks Chorale, and then we have, I don't know the acronym, the orchestra, local orchestra. So both use that art space within our building.
And you also have a theater, is that correct?
We do have the E.B. Ball Auditorium, which I recently found out was the Ball family helped to donate money to the Masons when they were building. And so they helped fund that auditorium and the colonnade with the large kitchen. So our auditorium needs some updates. That's maybe something we're kind of looking at, and how can we better use that space. But yes, we have a beautiful auditorium that can fit about 1,000.
Wow.
So,
yeah, that's substantial.
Yeah.
Well, no wonder it's taking a bit of time to figure out, you know, how you can serve the community, because you have so many things you can offer.
Yes. Took this position, and the minute I stepped in the building, the word potential was just saying over and over in my head, because that space has so much potential. But, you know, how can we use it? How can we get the money to do it? That's, you know, the big question. Money, always.
Of course. Well, are you say you're thinking about how the community you can best serve the community or what the community needs. Have you done any type of surveying to the community or something like that?
I think that's on our it's on our to-do as we look at who we are and what we want to be. Prior, I can't speak for 5 months ago prior.
Sure, of course.
And coming up, I will sneak in Benji here. Benji of Smoking Horses, the local band. So he's going to perform for us on March 15th. And we are hiding rocks throughout the city.
What?
So we are doing 2 rocks a month, and we have been putting riddles. We're posting riddles on our Facebook and our social media. So the first rock has not been found. The second rock has been found. And if you find the rock, you get a ticket. It's called Rock the Arts. So we hid rocks around the city.
So currently you can go online and read a riddle to find this rock.
Yes.
Well, it's an exciting time at Cornerstone, and we really appreciate you being here. Can you tell people how to find that rock and find other things at Cornerstone?
Yeah, so you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. It's just Cornerstone Center for the Arts, and then our website is cornerstonearts.org.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
It's time for our latest installment of Conversations Between the Coasts. Jen Blackmer takes it from here.
We're here today with 2 local artists that I've been wanting to have a conversation with for a while now. We're very happy you can be with us today. We're here with 2 playwrights, Steve Molds and Diana Grisanti. Hi, Steve. You are a playwright, educator, and director.
Yes, I am.
And Diana, you are an assistant professor of playwriting at Ball State.
I am.
Awesome. So the reason I wanted to bring both of you in to talk is that you're both playwrights, you're both artists, and you're married.
We are, yeah. We met at playwriting school. We met in grad school.
That is true. You met at playwriting school, right?
Yep. We started writing together before we became a couple.
That's true.
And we are still writing together and still a couple.
Amazing. Yeah. So talk about that first project. What was that first project you both worked on together?
Oh, it was a collaborative piece we did. So we went to school at University of Texas at Austin, the Michener Center, and it was a collaborative piece in the New Works Festival there, and a friend of ours who's a scenic designer had an architectural background, and she wanted to do a piece around like a utopian city of her design. And so she asked playwrights she knew to write pieces about the fictional history of this utopian city, and Diana and I ended up sort of being the head writers and working together to edit the piece.
Wow. So when was that performed? How did it go?
So with the festival at UT Austin, it's very open. People can do full productions, people can do readings, people can do sort of between readings and full productions.
Sure, yeah.
So devised, I would say dance pieces. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Lizzie Bracken, our brilliant friend, created the model for the city. And then that became our set. And then the rest was very bare bones.
Wow.
So we were looking at a model as if you were looking at a model at a museum. So when you were watching the play, you saw this model and then you saw a bunch of actors behind with script. It was a script in hand reading of all these sort of vignettes about the city.
Mm-hmm.
So the model really became the focal point. And then there was a big reveal at the end.
Well, our job was writers. Our job as writers was to come up with what was it that made this city, this utopian society, fall?
Yeah.
And,
oh wow.
And it was a plague of frogs that we dropped onto the model at the end of the reading.
Just because?
You know,
because
what?
These things happen.
It's been a very long time since I read that script. I don't remember how we got to the frogs.
And then, so that was the first project you worked together. And then was that when Love at First Sight sort of came raining down like frogs or what?
No, I would not say we were Love at First Sight. We were best friends first.
Oh,
and
nice.
Then, yeah, I was just thinking about this the other day. Like, I grew up and like my foundational romantic text was When Harry Met Sally.
Of course.
And so to me, you know, love grows out of friendship, and Diana is still my best friend as well as my partner. So yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and that was before we were together, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, No, because it was actually the spring of 2011.
Oh yeah, I guess we.
So this is until we were a couple.
Okay.
Yeah. So there you go, America. We put together the timeline.
So, tell me what it's like with two writers in the same household. Do you have separate spaces that you can work in, or is it all kind of, you know, more fluid that way? How does that work?
We do have an upstairs office that is either too hot or too cold, mm-hmm. depending on the time of year. And so one of us can be in there. I often set up at the dining table, which is less than ideal for our family. But I don't know. We don't have a specific – there's not like a specific area that's like, this is Mom's writing room or this is Dad's writing room.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of flow.
Yeah. So it is a little bit more fluid then. And
it's definitely fluid. And when we write together, which we don't always do, but when we do, mm-hmm. It's a lot of talking and brainstorming on road trips or on walks.
Yeah.
And then we go away to different spaces to write usually, and we
give each other assignments. So, you know, one of us will be in charge of a particular scene or a mm-hmm. particular part of the play, and then we'll come back together and then rewrite each other's work.
Nice.
When we write plays together.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what kind of, Diana, I'll ask you this. What kind of things are you drawn to? What kinds of stories are you drawn to yourself versus like what might be more of a collaborative experience?
Yeah. Okay. Things that I'm obsessed with. I'm obsessed with ghosts. I love ghost stories, but ghosts in like a very broad sense, meaning things that haunt. So not necessarily like, ooh,
right.
But history, culture, trauma. I mean, everybody mm-hmm. loves trauma these days, but it makes for good drama. Mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with
the Catholic Church.
The Catholic Church and folk Catholicism. Mm-hmm. How like specific communities interpret doctrine and turn it on its head. Mm-hmm. I'm also obsessed with sports, the structure of sports, and also how we care for each other, specifically reproductive labor. So how mm-hmm. do we care for children? How do we care for the elderly? How do we live in community? And I'm obsessed with late stage capitalism, mm-hmm. I guess.
Well, as we all are, to a certain extent, because this is what we're living, right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit. You have a play that is available on Audible. Is that correct?
I do.
Yeah, talk about that.
Vanessa in Bed is mm-hmm. the name of the play. That came about. Audible has a program called the Audible Emerging Playwrights. So they commission playwrights to write a piece for audio. They give you very few guidelines. It's just write a play for audio, do whatever you want. So it was a great challenge to try to figure out, okay, how do I tell a story and make it accessible just through sound mm-hmm. and words? And so I came up with this play, Vanessa in Bed, about a woman who does a bed rest study it's for a fake space exploration company called Parallax. It's sort of based on the actual bed rest studies that NASA does, but Parallax is a for-profit space exploration company of my design. So it's on Audible if y'all want to listen.
Amazing. All right. So Steve, what kind of stories are you drawn to?
Well, Diana had a really good list. That was a fantastic list. I'm very big on like Twilight Zone-y type stories. So not exactly sci-fi, but where reality is bending but it looks like real life, but then it's just slightly creepier or weirder.
Mm-hmm. You're interested in the uncanny.
The uncanny. That would be the pithy way of the way to sum that up. I'm interested in that for sure, but a lot of times I'm also just interested in what's a premise or what's a container to get a bunch of people together. Mm-hmm. I've written a lot of plays that were commissioned where the cast was assembled first. Mm-hmm. And so then, like, what's the sort of narrative excuse to get the characters together? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times for, you know, writing commissions for theater for young audiences, or, you know, it's like, what's the eye-catching premise that's going to get people to sign up for the summer camp for these kids to be in this play?
Right. Excellent. Yes.
Yeah. So, like, this last summer I did, like, what's essentially Jumanji Dungeons and Dragons. Right? That's the way. That was my very, yes, very excellent. Quick pitch to the producing company.
Yeah. So, and you recently had a play at the Phoenix down in Indianapolis. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that was called The Body. And that is definitely my most Twilight Zone-y play.
Exactly.
That's a play about a stepfather and stepdaughter during COVID who are home alone for a week. And they're haunted by a recent family grief, which ends up being a miscarriage. And a faceless doll arrives at the house. Mm-hmm. And the stepfather has not processed his grief. And he comes to believe that it's the spirit of the child who wasn't born.
Wow.
And madness ensues.
Of course.
Yeah.
So I'm sensing some commonality, I think, between where the two of you sort of see your own individual work. And the word haunting was brought up by both of you. Talk about the latest collaborative project that you've just done, which closed recently. It was with Kentucky Shakespeare. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, Kentucky Shakespeare in Louisville. So Kentucky Shakes commissioned us to write. Let me back up a little bit. 2 years ago, they commissioned us to write sort of a haunted house Hamlet, which we did, which we called Enter Ghost. And then this past year.
Which is a line from Hamlet. It's actually not a line. It's a stage direction from Hamlet. Yeah.
So then after Enter Ghost, they commissioned us to write a haunted house Macbeth, which we did. And that one is called Untimely Ripped. So that just closed down in Louisville. And
yeah,
so haunted house theater. Talk about what that is.
Well, Kentucky Shakespeare does an October play every single year. It's a big part of their season. And Matt Wallace, the artistic director, he really wanted to do an immersive piece where the audience gets to move around and you know, you feel like you can see little things that might be just for you. That was the vibe. And his idea was to use the silent disco headphones so that people could be on different channels.
So, yeah, and that's for our listeners who may not know what a silent disco is. Explain how that works.
So, you know, if you're actually like at a silent disco dancing event, you would have multiple channels and you can decide what music you want to listen to while you dance. But everyone has headphones on, so, you know, people are sometimes listening to different things and you're,
and bopping to different rhythms. And so I've seen a silent disco from the outside, and it can actually be kind of funny because it's
just sure.
So from the outside, it's just people silently dancing.
Yeah. Yes.
So you're all sort of having a private experience, but you're also still in community.
Yeah.
And that's the vibe of these plays as well. So we have three different audio channels, and people move through the experience on different tracks based on their color, mm-hmm. the color of their headphones.
Sure.
And they have different guides guiding them through, and you know, but like writing wise, the prompt was sort of, you know, we're looking for spookiness, we're looking for an unforgettable experience for the audience, but for us as writers, we're also looking for like what's the way to take this Shakespeare play that's well known, and then kind of remix it, but also like find a way to tell a story that is not the story of the play, but uses the story of the play as a source.
Exactly.
And for the two plays, I think we did very different takes on the two plays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first one was sort of a what if the story of Hamlet, but they're all in purgatory because they died without having confessed their sins. That was the idea behind Enter Ghost. And Untimely Ripped is more of a riff on English and Scottish history.
Okay.
Yeah. The Macbeth is one of the source texts, but I would say the other big source text would be the demonology of King James. So I didn't know this history. King James was obsessed with witches. Oh, wow. He wrote a whole book about them. He was terrified that witches were going to undermine his rule. And so the play is really a riff on that, and which is where the reproductive labor comes in, because so many people labeled as witches were actually midwives.
Midwives, exactly, yeah.
So, you know, there are resonances in today's society, as I'm sure you can imagine. But yeah, we got really into witches.
And how do you write multiple tracks of a story? Did you work together on all of it? Did you sort of separate a little bit of the labor and then sort of come together? How did that work out?
Well, it starts actually with the director created a ground plan. And so we were given, like,
so you wrote for a space.
We wrote for a space, and we wrote for a series of traffic patterns.
And for time.
Yeah. And so, and you know, as writers, like, we're very much engineers. We love logistics. We love parameters. Mm-hmm. The tracks, ultimately, everybody swings back around and gets everything. They just get it in a different order.
Sure. Yeah.
But in terms of divvying it up, we outlined it together. And then for the first draft, I wrote acts 1 and 5, and Steve wrote acts 2 through 4. And then we read it. And then we did a gigantic rewrite. And I honestly cannot remember
what, but that's good, though, because then as it begins to evolve, it becomes really the work of both of you. Yeah.
We have a running joke, because we wrote a big serialized piece several years ago, and Steve would always compliment my lines. And then I would be like, you wrote that line.
And I'm like, I really had forgotten.
Oh, but yeah, we do forget who wrote. And at a certain point, we usually have the same notes and often the same strategies for implementing the notes. So.
Of course. Yeah. And how did audiences respond to Untimely Ripped?
I think it was a big hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sold well, and I don't know, it's strange to be to say we had a hit, but I think it was a hit.
I think it was a hit. People are talking about it. I do think Kentucky Shakespeare has done an amazing job of creating this institution of what is Kentucky Shakespeare's Halloween play going to be.
Yeah.
People definitely get really into it. Louisville's kind of haunted. I think a lot of cities are, but people are super into doing events in October. Right. So they go see a play, they go on a ghost tour, they go see the pumpkins at Iroquois Park. It's a whole thing.
So let's talk about you as artists who live in the Midwest, because that's obviously a topic that interests me, right? And we know that Diana, you came to Muncie for a job, and now that you're here, what do you see the relationship of artists who work in the Midwest versus artists who maybe choose to live elsewhere, right? You've chosen to be here and talk about why.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I think there is an idea out there that you can only be an artist in New York or LA or Chicago, but we know this isn't true. And I think that a lot of how I, like, my perception of playwrights really started when I was like growing up in Louisville, because we had the Humana Festival. So I saw new plays being made in Louisville. Then I went to the University of Iowa for undergrad, where there's an MFA playwriting program. So I saw new plays being made in Iowa. And then I came back to Louisville for an internship at Actors Theatre of Louisville. And that year in the Humana Festival,
and tell our tell our listeners about the Humana Festival. What was the Humana Festival?
Yeah, so the Humana Festival was a giant new play festival that happened in Louisville, Kentucky, funded by the insurance company. Yeah. So that's where Humana comes from.
At Actors Theater of Louisville.
And one of the largest in the country for a while. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know exactly where it stands right now, but Actors Theater is still producing new work, rest assured.
Yes.
But the year that I interned on the festival, all of the playwrights were also professors at different universities. So I saw firsthand like a way of life that looked really appealing to me. I could write, I could teach, I could live in a place that wasn't congested. I could live in a place where I didn't have to have a commute. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, New York never really appealed because I just saw this other path so clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is that Actors Theater of Louisville background is something that we share. When we met in Texas, I had done the same internship as Diana 5 years earlier, and I had been on staff at Actors Theater of Louisville. So I, over the years, I worked on 8 different Humana festivals and had the same kind of grounding in the robust kind of new play culture that they mm-hmm. have. Mm-hmm. So for me, you think about it just like logistically, for a playwriting career, the only real way to make money, big time money, is to have a play that goes to Broadway mm-hmm. or a play gets made into a movie or something. But generally, I mean, you can have a play that plays across the country and that's great and mm-hmm. that can make a decent amount of money. Mm-hmm. But actually, the vast majority of plays are local events. I mean, they're all fundamentally yes. local events because they have an audience right there. But they really are just, they happen in a handful of places. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, living in this part of the country, in Indiana, and in Kentucky, it's more about quality of life and about, well, you make the relationships you can make where you live. Mm-hmm. But you can have a career if you piece together all the jobs and all the and you keep your relationships and you
that's right
you know and so much of our work so much of both of our work has been commissions you mm-hmm. know just getting an institution to commission us you know to write a play to write a new play for that summer academy that the kids are going to be in or to write a piece
for an immersive Shakespeare.
to write the Halloween play this year, to write a short piece for an anthology, a holiday anthology. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, I think of it as like a series of writing assignments. And that is a very satisfying way. I feel like it's very satisfying creatively, as opposed to I think of it as I pour my heart and soul into something and then I find out that nobody likes it.
Right. Which is always the danger,
right? It's like you write, you know, that I mean, I'm sure there are novelists out there yes. every day feeling intense self-loathing. Uh-huh. And I'd much rather just write something on assignment.
Yeah.
And bring all the artistry I can to that assignment.
I think of writing a lot as like Top Chef, which I am a devoted fan of. But having like a prompt is yeah. really useful. And a lot of times, I don't know if y'all know this, on Top Chef, people flail when they don't have any parameters anymore, when it's just like cook the best meal of your life.
You're like, wait, then, what?
Yeah. So as a playwright, I either create my own prompt or somebody else creates it for me, usually. Occasionally, I have to cook the best meal of my life.
So we were talking about sources of income, and Steve, I'd be a little remiss if I didn't point out that one of your sources of income a little while ago was actually offered to you by somebody named Alex Trebek. Yes?
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Can you share that with our listeners? Share that experience?
Yes, I was on Jeopardy back in 2019, and it was one day of filming. I won 3 games and something like $85,000. And that was probably the most intense day of my life.
I'll bet.
Just adrenaline city all day long. Yeah, and it couldn't have come at a better time. I mean, the check came basically right at the end of 2019. And as we all know how 2020 turned out. So that was amazing timing
for
a family of playwrights. But yeah, it was just an incredible experience. And I have to say, like, one of the best places for, a creative person or a writer to go, because you amass so many random bits of knowledge over the course of a writing career. And it's like, oh, finally, I get to use all this stuff.
Yeah, that's excellent. And did you return? You returned for Tournament of Champions at one point.
Yes, I did go back to the Tournament of Champions, and I fell flat on my face, did horribly. I did get my final Jeopardy correct, but all the other champions were like the nicest human beings in the world. We're mm-hmm. all still on a group text. They are lovely people, and we're all friends, and it's great.
And Steve has a very lovely essay about the experience.
He does,
On salon.com, so.
We've been talking today with Steve Molds and Diana Grisanti. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in and spending some time and talking about your work together as well as separately as playwrights.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
Thanks, Jen. This was great.
I'm Jen Blackmer.
I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Kara Duquette. For this week's What Are You Working On?, we're here with musician Joshua Powell. I wanted to start by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about your music.
Yeah. Happily, yeah. I started playing in 2011 as Joshua Powell in The Great Train Robbery when I was a college student in Indiana. I grew up playing in punk and hardcore bands in a small town in South Florida. But then when I got to liberal arts season of my life, people handed me a flannel shirt and said, "We listen to Wilco now." you get to college and you got to do Radiohead homework. And so I did that. Started this band out of the dissolution of another attempt at an indie rock band, just playing under my own name now. But I've been doing it ever since I graduated full time. We've done almost 1,000 shows now in 43 states and 3 countries. Wow. And the music has evolved and portal hopped across genres in a lot of different incarnations. But it began in sort of like a down-home folk rock sort of neighborhood. And then we took a turn for the indie rock, and then we took a turn for the psychedelic, and now we're making a heavy album, which I don't know what people are going to do with it, but I never know what they're going to do with it until I put it out there.
I love the idea of portal genre hopping. That's great.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So can you talk to us a little bit about, you said your music has evolved and you're in the heavier zone. And yeah. I think I read something about metalcore. Can you talk about what that is?
Isn't it so funny? Like just genres in general, just like what is it? Is it rock or is it classic rock now? Like how old is it? What's the vintage of this? Or, you know, the funniest, I mean, in EDM, don't even, you know, tell somebody like, "Oh, I like that techno music." You're going to get punched in the face by a raver. It's like, this isn't techno. This is drum and bass. You primate, you Philistine, this is IDM. And no one is worse at that crap than heavy music fans. Metal people will be like, "What do you mean that's brutal technical death metal? That's obviously technical brutal death metal."
opened a can of worms.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a can that I'm so deep into, like a Pringles can, like I can't get my fist out because I'm trying to figure out how to market this crap. And I mean, I think the music that we're making really, I might even be shooting myself in the foot by trying to reach out to metal audiences, because our thesis is making this album like, well, let's make metal for people who think they don't like metal. And be like, "Well, I don't listen to that stuff." And it's like, well, but try this out, because we still have an attention to top line melody and the aesthetic sensibilities that make pop music shiny. We want to bring that in and make a low threshold of accessibility. I still want to go yeah on a breakdown sometimes, but you know, like Linkin Park changed the world by like bringing some of those sounds into the mainstream, and Linkin Park had radio hits where Chester's yelling his face off. So to answer your actual question, metalcore is great because everyone hates it together. Metal people hate it because it's not brutal enough, and then hardcore people hate it because it's not so punk. It's taking the sing-song anthemic choruses of the metal, but then combining them with yelling and breakdowns. And you put it all together, it's just like a spiritual pummeling. It makes me feel good.
So I think people might like a spiritual pummeling, right?
I hope so. I hope I find those people. Come be in my weird church.
Well, are you working on an album right now?
Yes. Yes, we are halfway through our next LP that will be released in 2025 on Romanus Records. We're working on the sixth song right now. I think there's going to be 10.
Well, when you say they're not done, like they're not recorded, or is everything written?
It's all written.
Like, how does that happen? How do you write a song? Like, how does that happen for you? Is there?
Yeah, great cue. It has definitely changed a lot over the years. It's different now, more so than it ever has been, because primarily, historically, I would sort of orchestrate every instrument in the arrangement, and then if I couldn't play it myself, bring in someone, hire someone to play that part. But pretty much I would imagine the song realized and then have people execute the vision. Now, about the same time that I dropped the band name, Great Train Robbery, and just like, I'm just Joshua Powell, it's just me out here, let's not, you know, have any bones. Yeah, right. It's just, oh gosh, too. And it's such a folky name, right? And it's also a whole short story of a name to try to yell at somebody over a dive bar din. But now, about the same time, I was like, I'm really a solo artist. We became a band by accident. Like, we really locked in with my brother Jacob joined back up, and he sings harmonies and plays drums like a god. And then Josh Townsend is like the greatest bass player in all galaxies combined. And he's been with me for like 8 or 9 years or something, which is insane. So now, basically, I will do that same. I'll make a demo on my laptop and go, this is the idea. Imagine like this. It's a sketch, right? But then I work really hard to not get married to any of those things, because I trust Jacob and Josh more than I've ever trusted any other artistic collaborators. So when I show them, I'm like, I don't know, it's something like this maybe. They'll be like, yeah, but wouldn't it be cooler if we chopped this and if we reimagined this? And so I take the demo, I show them the demo, we all get in the garage rehearsal space and spend a day or two hacking at the pieces and reconstructing it, and then going and recording it. And there's still fun parts too after we get the rhythm bed recorded, because once we've played guitar, bass, and drums, we all sit around for another couple of days plunking out weird stuff on synthesizers or finding samples to cut in and doing all the sound design and post-production that the Easter eggs that make it like a rich and cinematic texture that you can get a lot of like re-listen value to. It's like, oh, I never heard that little coin sound in there before. We hide a lot of coins in our music. Ba-ding!
That one was overt. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, when you say that, are the songs related in the album, or are they?
Yes, okay. Yes. Do you want a hot drop? Do you want some news on the radio that hasn't been announced in official capacities?
Joshua, yes.
Okay. The album that's coming out in 2025 on Romanus Records is called Becoming a Witch. That's the thesis. It's an album about penumbras. It's about thinking that something is one thing when it's not. People have a connotation with magic that it's evil. Magic is not evil. Magic is all-encompassing, good and evil, light and dark. It's alchemical thinking that predates many of the religions that we subscribe to today. So it's not a freaking thesis. Like, I'm not trying to prove anything or change anybody's mind, but it is songs that share in common a sense of recognition of your own agency, believing that, you know, if we live in a system that's comprised of energy and we become conscious of that, then we have the agency to be able to manipulate that energy, and that's magic power. When I realized that for myself, that's pretty much all I could think about for the rest of my life. And music is magic as well. The fact that you can take art, you can create something from nothing, and then it can go affect somebody else in a powerful way. That's spellcraft, baby.
That's really cool. I like that. I like your, I don't know, your vibe, the way you talk about things and the way you blend music together, and talking about the penumbras, right? The gray areas, the places where we can insert ourselves and like what we love.
Yeah.
And make magic.
Yeah.
That's Cheers. Really cool.
All right. Well, thanks. I'm glad you're vibing with it.
Well, can you tell us where we can find you online and listen to some of this?
For sure. Joshua Powell Music is the handle on all social media. Get me on that TikTok, kids. I love TikTok. I'm on Instagram the most. Facebook, those are all Joshua Powell Music. And then, I mean, Spotify, please stream, put it on repeat while you dream. I need those 75 cents. I'm not actually complaining. I don't care where people stream it. I just want them to know the words and sing them to me back at the shows.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah,
that's magic, baby.
Well, we really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thank you for having me in. This is so fun.
Kara, it is time to find out what's going on in and around East Central Indiana. Why don't you kick us off?
Sounds good. Saturday, November 16th is Piano Day at Sursa Performance Hall at Ball State. The event is open to the public and includes Piano Palooza at 5:30 p.m., featuring performances by several piano faculty members.
All for one and one for all. The Three Musketeers opens this weekend in University Theater, presented by Ball State's Department of Theater and Dance. Tickets and more info at bsu.edu/theaterdance.
The fall short play series will include 4 1 acts running in rotation on the Ball State campus through November 23rd. Plays include English Made Simple, Time Flies, Seagulls, and A Betrothal. Specific show days and times available at bsu.edu/theaterdance.
The Richmond Museum of Art will have its Art on the Green event next Thursday, November 21st. The event is your chance to buy artwork, originals, and prints from people in the community who no longer have a place for it in their collections. RichmondArtMuseum.org is the place to go for more info.
Blackford County Arts Center, part of the Arts Place family, is presenting the Alcove Arts and Friends exhibit. On display now through December 17th. More info at myartsplace.org.
Open Space Art About the Land is on display at the Anderson Museum of Art, a partnership between Minnetrista and Red Tail Land Conservancy. The exhibit is an annual juried art show. The exhibit will be on display through January 5th. AndersonArt.org is the place to go.
I'm so excited. There's so much art.
I know.
Now that it's getting chilly outside, Saturday, November 16th, you can catch a performance by Mason and Vaughn at Tunney Winery. The music begins at 7 p.m. And Jake Hendershot will perform Wednesday, November 20th at Belgian Horse Winery. Music begins at 6:30 p.m.
That is a packed calendar. I hope everybody finds something to do in and around East Central Indiana this weekend and beyond.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who loves noodles and has aged 10 years in the last 40 episodes. Our show was hosted by me, Kara Duquette,
and me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.